Our speaker today is Bill Lepp, and his bio that he wrote said, "When I was a child, I didn't know who the poor were. So when we did canned drives around town, I always took from our house the food I hated the most. Through a series of humorous but eye-opening events, I learned who the poor are and that they deserved my generosity." Bill Lepp is an award-winning professional storyteller, humorist, author, and recording artist. His book, The King of Little Things, won the Penn Stephen Kroll Award for picture book writing, and he has been a featured teller at the National Storytelling Festival since 2002. Lepp has published several books and 25 or so audio recordings, and he lives in West Virginia. So welcome to Minnesota, and welcome to our group today.
When I was a little kid, every now and again in our town, we'd have a can drive. You know, like take a can of food to the library, get your fine reduced, or take a can of food to church, get in free. And I didn't really know what this was about, and so I would ask, who are these cans of food for? And my parents or other adults would say, they're for the poor. Well, I didn't really know who the poor were. I'm the last of five children, and I don't know if you're the last of a long line of children, but if you are, you know that people never get tired of saying you're everyone else's responsibility, or you're everyone's responsibility, which means nobody is teaching you anything. So I was 19 before I knew the difference between my shoulder and my elbow. And so people would say, this food is for the poor, and I didn't know. My parents knew who the poor was. My dad had been the minister in town for all my life. My mother was a teacher at the public schools, but it's just, to that point, no one had sat me down in a car and driven me around town and said, these people are the poor, these people are the poor. And so I did what kids do. I just thought it through. And there was a guy in our church. He wasn't old. He was older than my parents, but he wasn't old. And his wife had died. His name was Mr. Peterson, and a lot of the widows in town, I would hear them say things like, poor Mr. Peterson, his wife died, I'm going to take him a casserole, poor Mr. Peterson, I'm going to take him to dinner. And so I thought that Mr. Peterson was the poor. So I thought when we did can drives, all of these cans of food went to poor Mr. Peterson. And I didn't like poor Mr. Peterson. So when I would go into the pantry to get food for the food drive, I would get the things that I liked the least. I would get the canned beets and the canned peas because those are awful. And in my mind, in my child's mind, I thought that if I took the canned beets and peas out of the pantry, that my mother wouldn't be able to get any more. I didn't know that there was an inexhaustible supply of canned beets down at the grocery store. And my brothers and sisters did the same thing. They would go, and we would come out, five of us, we would come out with like 20 cans. And my mother would be like, no, we can't give all that away. And we weren't rich by American standards, obviously. My dad was a minister. My mom was a teacher. So we didn't go out to eat very often. And that was for several reasons. One, there was no restaurant in the county that I grew up in. And two, because there were five of us. And on the rare occasions that we did go out to eat, my father would take us in the kitchen and sit us down and make us all have a milk drinking contest before we went to the restaurant. And when I was a little kid, the McDonald's Happy Meal came out. And again, on the rare occasions I could talk my adults into going to McDonald's, we would always go through the drive-thru, and they would order our food, and then we would pull like 100 yards away, and either my mother or father would go through everything to make sure everything was right, and then they would hand me my Happy Meal, and we would drive away, and every single time, there was no toy in my Happy Meal. And my parents would say, well, we're too far away to go back now. And I was so upset about that that at Christmas time, I wrote Santa and said I didn't get any toys in my Happy Meal, and lo and behold, on Christmas morning, in my stocking were all of the Happy Meal toys. It was just a miracle. So I started to figure out, well, I found out who the poor were when I was in the probably the 7th or 8th grade. We were having a food drive at our church, and my buddy Skeeter, he lived next door to me, he hated canned salmon. His mother made something called salmon croquettes, and there's generally two reactions to that. One is, and the other is, ooh. And we were in the ooh category. Mrs. Bart would take canned salmon, pat that in flour, make a patty, pat that in flour, and fry it. And Skeeter would call me and say, do you want to come over to our house for supper? And I would stick my head out the door and sniff. And if I smelled that, I would say no. So Skeeter and I came into the fellowship hall at the church to do this can drive, and the only other person in the fellowship hall was poor Mr. Peterson. And there were tables and tables of boxes and canned food. And he looked at us, and he said, what did you bring? And I thought, that's rude. You're not supposed to ask what your gift is. And then I said, canned beets and peas. And he said, why? And I said, because I don't like canned beets and peas. And he said to Skeeter, what did you bring? And Skeeter said, salmon. And he said, why? And Skeeter said, same reason. And he said, go get in my truck. And so we went and we got in poor Mr. Peterson's truck. And it was interesting to me because he was the poor in my mind. And yet he had a brand new Ford F-150 truck. And I thought, where do you get money for this? Are you selling these beets and peas? Is there a black market for canned foods? I thought, man, how much canned food do you have? I thought, this guy probably has a barn full of canned food. And I thought, he probably has a barn made out of canned food. And we got in his truck, and we started to drive around town, and we pulled up in front of a house, and poor Mr. Peterson said, go put a box of food on their porch. And we said, why? And he said, because they're poor. And Skeeter said, they're not poor. That's the Dedaliuses. We go to school with them. They're not poor. And poor Mr. Peterson said, well, Mr. Dedalius, he went into the coal mines, and even though he's only like 40 years old, he can't work anymore because he got black lung. He can barely get off the couch. He can't get a job. Mrs. Dedalius is having a hard time getting a job. They're poor. And so we got out of the truck, and we put a box of food on the porch of friends of ours. And then we drove around town, and we kept putting boxes of food on porches of people that we knew. And in the drive time, Mr. Peterson would give us these little sermonettes. Now, just trigger warning, Unitarians, I'm about to say Jesus. He would give us these little sermonettes as we drove around town, and he would say things like, when Jesus fed the 5,000, he had a couple of fish and a few loaves of bread, and he multiplied that into food, and he handed it to the disciples, and he said to the disciples, feed them. That's all he said. He didn't say to ask them if they had a job, or if they worked 20 hours a week, or were in job training, or if they were addicted to drugs or alcohol, or if they were in a program to get sober, or what their life was like. Jesus just said, feed them. He didn't say, ask them any questions at all. And then we would get out and put a box of food on the porch, and we would get back in the truck. And he said, Proverbs 14:31, he who oppresses the poor insults their maker. He who is generous to the poor honors their maker. And then he said, he who oppresseth the poor reproacheth his maker. He who is generous with the poor honoreth his maker. He said, if you learn it in the King James Version, they can't argue with you. So we drove around town just putting boxes of food on porches of people that we knew. And we finally got back to the church, and it was still just the three of us. And poor Mr. Peterson asked again, why did you bring beets and peas and salmon? And I said, because I don't like beets and peas and salmon. And he said, but why did you bring it? And I said, because honestly, poor Mr. Peterson, I didn't call him that. I said, honestly, Mr. Peterson, I thought it was for you. And I don't like you. And he said, I don't like you either. And And then the door of the church opened, and our friend Charlay came in. Now, Charlay was the daughter of Angus Fester. Angus Fester was a dairy farmer who loved cattle so much that he had named all of his children after different breeds of cattle. So there was Angus Jr., Hereford, Beefalo, Longhorn, Guernsey, Jersey. And Guernsey and Longhorn were the twins, which doesn't... Right? It doesn't make any sense. Guernsey and Jersey should be the twins. That's a little geography joke for you. And then when Helen, Mrs. Fester, finally had a daughter, she knew that Angus was going to name her after a breed of cattle, so she said at least make it feminine, and that's where Charlay got her name. And we had grown up with Charlay. Skeeter and Charlay had been in love since like the second grade. Now that we were in junior high, they were more officially boyfriend and girlfriend. They didn't go to our church. Charlay wasn't in our youth group. So they came in the church. And I said, because I'm a genius, and I said, why are you here? And Charlay said, we're here to get food. And I was thinking all of this at the same time. I'd known her my entire life, and she had been to my house and to Skeeter's house plenty of times. But I had never been to her house, it occurred to me at that moment. And I said, why are you here? And she said, we're here to get food. And Mr. Peterson hit me, and I said, because I don't learn, this food is for the poor, and Mr. Peterson hit me harder. And Mrs. Fester, Charlay's mom, said, well, you know Angus, he doesn't work, he's often in trouble, he spends a lot of time in jail, and we have a difficult time making ends meet. And so I had to give a box of food to someone who I had grown up with. And now, whenever I do a can drive, I make sure that I take peanut butter and cherry pie filling. Let me just say, first of all, that story is not entirely true. It's important in the storytelling world to let the audience know what's not true. It's based on true, but it's not 100% true. So don't go home thinking, that guy did all of that. I'm not that good of a person. This person asked how I got started in storytelling. I come from a family where the truth is fluid. It was just always up to the listener to decide what was true. And the short answer is, since about the fourth grade, I wanted to be a writer. And I grew up in a time, like most of you, when there was not an internet where you could go and post things that you had written and people could come by and read it. So it was difficult to get anyone to read anything I had written. And then we have a contest in West Virginia every year called the West Virginia Liars Contest. And it's a tall tale telling contest. And I decided one year that I would write a story and tell it at the Liars Contest. And I won second place. And so what I learned from that is if you write a story and learn to say it out loud, people have to listen to you unless they can't outrun you. So I write my stories, I learn them, and I wear running shoes. And then I did that just around the state for about 10 years, and in 2000 I got invited to the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee to do a 15-minute spot, and 25 years later, here I am in Winona, Minnesota. So, well, thank you for saying Appalachian and not Appalachian. It's just a storytelling place. I don't know. We had a lot of people from like England and Ireland and Scotland that came in there, and they brought their jacktails, and they brought this weird sense of humility where you're not supposed to brag about yourself, but you can invent these characters that represent who you are and tell stories about them. And of course, Jack is this character who, he's not the smartest guy in the world, but he always manages to accomplish whatever he sets out to do, usually just through persistence and also kindness. In almost every Jack story, he meets somebody along the way who says, do you have anything to eat? And Jack says, well, I don't have much, but you can have half of what I have. And then he gets the amulet that helps him solve the mystery. So we come from this culture of people telling these, they're tall tales, but they're also subtle brags. And so it's just a thing for people to do, to sit around and tell stories. And it's definitely not just something that happens in Appalachia. I mean, people figured this out all over the country. people got tired of being in a restaurant and somebody say, what do you do? And they said, I'm a logger. Do you want to hear about that? And the guy said, no, that sounds dumb. And so they learned to say, well, there's this giant and he has a big blue ox and he can cut down more trees than a machine. Do you want to hear about that? And, oh, yeah, that sounds interesting. And so it's just, you know, a way for people to talk about themselves. But I don't know. There's just a lot of us from Appalachia who have turned it into a profession, I guess. Thought, I want to be funny, like Paul Hirschig. And so I just started to pay attention to what Paul Hirschig did. Paul Hirschig watching MASH and Looney Tunes. But no, I was one of those kids that I wasn't overtly bad. If I was doing something wrong, no one was going to find out about it. I didn't get detention until my senior year in high school. And then it was like the last week of school, and I had to go and do service hours in the office, and nobody else was in there. And so I thought, do I really have a permanent file? And I don't now. When I do the full version of that story that I just told, it's sad. And I do tell, mostly no. The quick answer is mostly no. There are plenty of storytellers who tell fantastic, sad, and tragic stories, and they do a great job at it. Sometimes I get accused of just being funny, but I have thought my entire career, and I think it just gets more important, that there are times when we just need to laugh. And if we can come together as a community and for half an hour come from all different backgrounds, all different walks of life, all different beliefs, just for 20 minutes, half an hour, sit there and laugh together, I think that that is as useful, if not more useful, than making everyone cry. That said, I do tell two stories that are pretty much word for word from World War II veterans, one guy who fought in Sicily and another guy that went through the Battle of the Bulge. And both of those stories are horrific and very sad, and so I don't tell them very often. Yeah, my kids just grew up in the storytelling world, and they were, for a while, they were sort of the surrogate grandchildren of all the other storytellers, and once a week we would get somebody's new CD in the mailbox. So we sit around the table. We play a game. This is a game I encourage all of you to play with your children, grandchildren. We play a game called, they ask us, what do you have now that you didn't have when you were kids, and what did you have as kids that we don't have now? And so that gets us all telling stories about our childhood and our past. Strike Anywhere Matches is a thing that my kids didn't know what that was when I told them, because they just, you hardly see Strike Anywhere Matches anymore. It trips my youngest daughter out that phones used to be connected to the wall. Like when we still had a wireless phone, my wife kept losing it, and my daughter said, someone ought to think of a way to connect that to the wall. She didn't really say that. I read that in Reader's Digest, and I stole it, but that's how you cite a source. And so we do tell a lot of stories. And now my oldest daughter she's written a 600-page novel. It's not published yet, but it's done. And my youngest daughter is a playwright and a director. She's just started her senior year in college. So they're both in the storytelling world. And my wife's a poet, so we're all word people around the family. I don't really. Here's the thing that I discovered a long time ago. My buddy Andy and I figured this out. We do a festival that's in a pretty conservative place out in Utah, and they kind of have a list of what we're not supposed to talk about. And what we discovered was that it's easier to offend a liberal than it is a conservative, because a conservative's only worried about themselves, but a liberal is willing to be offended on behalf of others. And so so it is different in different places, but everything I say on stage, I believe. And I'm willing to back up what I have to say about it. I think I'm careful about the things I say. People say to me, you're so subtle. And I'm like, I don't think what I just said was subtle. But obviously the climate has changed. There was a time when We had political leaders that we voted for, but we also believed that they were human and that they were going to make mistakes, and so we could point out the foibles in those people. And now we've entered more of a worship period, and when you make fun of certain politicians, you're questioning someone's entire life choices. So it is more difficult, but if I think it's important, I'm going to say it, unless it's a really big paycheck and I might be invited back. I don't want to, and I don't say that much that is shocking, I don't think. So I kind of live by this rule. My buddy Ed Stuyvenner, another storyteller, you know, said, don't take your audience hostage. Most people that come to a storytelling festival paid to come to get entertained. They didn't come to get a lecture or a political rally. And so I adhere by that ideal that most people aren't here. You've come for escape when you've come to a storytelling festival. And so I'm not going to throw a lot of my political or religious beliefs at you. If I'm doing something on a Sunday morning or sacred storytelling, then I feel like I can say more direct things. But I generally try, and here's two jokes that I make. In my stories, I have this town called Half Dollar, West Virginia, and if you're interested where it is, it's 832 miles southeast of Lake Wobegon. And I have these characters that I'm working really hard who present themselves in the stereotype that you have of Appalachia and West Virginia. They dress like you think they do, they have the accent you think they do, but they can quote Shakespeare or Newton's laws or whoever else. So I'm trying to dispel the stereotypes that people have about West Virginia and Appalachia. But I do have stupid people in my story, because it would be disingenuous to pretend there's no stupid people in West Virginia. We also have a legislature. And so I make that joke in every state I've ever been to, and I get exactly that reaction. People somehow elect their elected officials and then forget that they're responsible for that. And the other joke I make is my uncle, or my Skeeter's uncle, used to tell us stories, and then he would just get done and say, he wouldn't give us the moral, he'd say, dwell on that and maybe you'll learn something. And the first story he ever told us was Little Red Riding Hood. I'm not going to tell you Little Red Riding Hood because you know it, but also because in West Virginia, South Carolina, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, and Utah, you can't tell that story anymore, because at the end of that story, that wolf's in drag. And he's not asleep, so clearly he's woke. So I make that joke wherever I go because it pleases the people that are with me on that, but I also think it points out the ridiculousness of that argument to people who are anti-trans or anti-woke. I think, you know, they want to ban these books from school, but they're not thinking about the stories that we all grew up on. So, you know, I think that's important, and so I say that joke just about everywhere I go.
Is he still in your life?
He is as real as you want him to be. Skeeter and I met when we were 25. We actually met in divinity school, and we went to high schools that played each other in sports, so we probably saw each other in high school. But we didn't become friends until we were in our 20s, and so I invented our childhood so that we could lie to our children about what we did when we were their age. And so his kids call me Uncle Bill, my kids call him Uncle Skeeter. So yeah, he's real, he's in my life, but not everything that we do in our stories, in my stories, happened exactly the way I'd say. All the time. Most audiences, I don't say trigger warning, I'm going to mention Jesus. Yeah, I write my stories. It generally takes me about a year to put a story together, to write it, to learn it, to start figuring out how to say it best. But there's always things that each different audience gets a slightly different version of the story, and I react to different things that are going on in the audience and different people's expressions. I told a story last night where we have to shoot a washing machine because it's lame, and the audience has sympathy for this washing machine. It's amazing. I get in awe every time I tell the story. And then later in that same story, chickens are exploding and people think it's hilarious. And so I like to point out to the audience, how did you care about this washing machine but not about the chicken? So, and then a lot of times I make mistakes. One of the reasons it takes me 6 months to put a story together orally is because the written language and the spoken language are different languages, and so I have to figure out how to tell it. And then as I'm telling it, I'm figuring out how to say it best, what works, what doesn't work. And then sometimes I'll make a mistake, and you'll see a lot of storytellers do this. I will make a mistake on stage, and then I will have a reaction to that that also gets a laugh. And then if you watch me 10 years later, he made that same mistake and got the same laugh by fixing it. So things definitely creep into the story the longer I tell them, and they do change every time. Yeah, I mean, I had the advantage of doing it just around the state of West Virginia for 10 years, doing church spaghetti dinners, Cub Scout blue and gold banquets. So I had a lot of time in front of audiences, and I had, Dean Martin says, you don't learn to be funny by being funny on stage, you learn to be funny by not being funny on stage. And so I've always paid attention to how the audience reacts to what I have to say and how I'm saying it and how they're looking at me. And I do hope that I get better. And in the beginning, for the Liars Contest, you have a 5-minute time limit. And so all of my stories were 5 minutes, and they were just real basic tall tales. But as I have progressed, my stories have certainly gotten longer. They're not as tall tale. There's tall tale elements in almost each of my story, but they're not just solid tall tales. And then I have had more meaning creep into my stories, partly because I come back to a place with my third time here. And so once I've developed a relationship with an audience, I feel like I can say things to them that I didn't say the first time I was there. So there are things that creep into my stories. My stories have gotten slightly more meaningful over the years, yes.
For our musical meditation, we will hear from Johnson Street Underground, who will sing our final musical meditation, and Atheists, they have no songs.
Just to continue with the story theme, this is a story written with music by Steve Martin and the Steep Canyon Ragers.
You know, religious people have such beautiful stories and music and art, and atheists really have nothing. Until now, we have the entire atheist hymnal right here. It's a little ditty called Atheists Don't Have No Songs.
Christians have their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Havanagila for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists, yes. Just sing the blues.
Just sing the blues.
Romantics play
Clair de Lune.
Clair de Lune.
Baptists claim Saint He is risen.
But no one ever wrote a tune
for godless existentialism.
For atheists,
there's no good news.
They'll never sing
a song of faith.
For in their songs,
they have a rule.
The he is always lowercase. The he is always lowercase.
Some folks sing
a Bacchantata. Lutherans get Christmas trees. Atheist songs add up to nada.
But they do
have Sundays free.
Pentecostals sing
to heaven. Coptics have the Book of Scrolls. Numerologists count,
they count to seven.
Atheists have rock and roll.
For atheists.
There's no good news.
They'll never sing a song of faith.
For in their songs,
they have a rule. The he is always lowercase. The he is always lowercase.
Atheists
don't have no songs. Christians have their hymns and pages.
Hymns and pages.
Hallelujah for the Jews.
For the Jews.
Baptists have the Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Atheists just sing the blues.
Catholics
dress up for mass
and listen to
Gregorian chants.
Atheists
just take a pass
and watch football in their underpants. Watch football in their underpants.
Atheists don't have no soul.
Don't have no soul.